Die Gegensprechanlage.
Willkommen bei der Gegensprechanlage. Grail Marcus lebt in Berkeley und ist Kulturjournalist und Analytiker. In seinem bekanntesten Buch Lipstick Traces, A Secret History of the 20th Century nimmt er den Leser mit auf eine Tour de force von Dada bis Punk. Wir haben ihn über die Beziehungen von Kultur und Politik in den Vereinigten Staaten unter Bush befragt, über Popkultur bei den Republikanern und Popkultur bei den Demokraten, den ersten Zeremonienmeister Ronald Reagan, seinen Wurf quer durch Amerika und den Mann mit dem Saxophon.
I think this really begins with Ronald Reagan. Reagan had a great sense of culture. Not surprisingly, he was an actor. He made movies for many, many years. And he was very involved in Hollywood politics long before he became governor of California or president. And he had a great ability to insert himself in any situation as the sort of master of culture. And he could appropriate any figure, any song, any event. And so when he would have Michael Jackson at the White House, he was able to pull that off and not seem uncomfortable or embarrassed. He wanted to, in the United States, the biggest sports event of the year is the Super Bowl. And Reagan had this idea. There's a tradition also that the president often throws out the first ball of the first game of the season. And that means that he stands and he throws a ball to the catcher. It's a ceremony. Reagan had an idea for the Super Bowl that he would be photographed, he'd be filmed on the lawn of the White House throwing a football, and then you'd see the ball go up into the air, and then somebody else would throw a football in the stadium where the game was happening, and they would film it so it looked as if he'd thrown the football halfway across the country, and it, you know, came into the stadium and somebody caught it. You know, is it like he threw it 1,000 miles? That's what he wanted to do. And his staff talked him out of it. But that really represented his notion of culture. It is something to command. It's something to own. He is the would be the superstar in any situation. And he was really good at that. With Clinton, you know, he was much younger. He liked pop music. He liked rock and roll. He knew how to play it. His playing Heartbreak Hotel on TV during the campaign in 1992 is the thing that really turned his campaign around. Clinton, as the Democrat, the candidate of one of the major parties, was so far behind Bush and Perot, he was not even a factor. When he went on television and played Heartbreak Hotel on his saxophone, people all over the country started paying attention to him. They started saying, this is a real person. This is interesting. And I'm not saying people then decided to vote for him, but he became alive in the public imagination in a way that he hadn't been before.
Der Besitzanspruch der Republikaner auf die amerikanische Kultur. Zitat.
Es ist, als würden die Puritaner nach 300 Jahren amerikanischer Geschichte jene Gesellschaft zurückfordern, die sie einst gegründet haben. Gott und seine Ergebenen schauen auf Amerika und teilen die Auserwählten von den Taugenichtsen, die Erlösten von den Verdammten.
Zitat Ende. Grail Marcus, 1981 im Rolling Stone, nachdem Ronald Reagan zum Präsidenten gewählt wurde.
What's important is the way in which a president can communicate his ownership of the country. Now that is not a democratic way of doing things. That is not the way Democrats do things, but it is the way Republicans do things. Republicans do believe that they, as a group, are the rightful owners of the country. And so a Republican president can project or communicate ownership. And that's what Bush does in his whole manner. As a figure on television, he is able to communicate mastery, control, ease, and pleasure in whatever he does. So the fact that he was pretending to play a guitar at a fundraiser when Hurricane Katrina was destroying New Orleans, people said, oh, he's just playing a guitar and he should have been doing something about New Orleans. It's much more important for him to be pretending to play a guitar and show how comfortable he is with his ownership of the country than to actually do anything.
Terry Shiloh war eine klinisch tote Frau. Ihr Körper wurde von Maschinen am Leben erhalten, die ihr Mann abschalten wollte. Nachdem sich die Geschichte in eine landesweite Debatte auswuchs, wollte Bush per Gesetz den Anspruch auf das Leben dieser Frau auf die US-Regierung übertragen. Ein Bundesrichter annullierte den Antrag.
Als die Armee ausrückte, um eine klinisch tote Frau aus dem Krankenhaus zu holen.
Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, was planning to send state marshals to the hospital where she was being kept alive to seize her body. I mean, she was still alive, but she was really just a body. And the local sheriff said, no, you're going to have to shoot it out with my deputies. And he surrounded the hospital with his own deputies. And you could have had a situation where the state went to war against the county sheriff. That would have been quite something. This was all for the benefit of a very small part of the electorate. This was all a publicity stunt. They don't give a damn about this woman. They don't care about keeping somebody alive and the right to life or any of that. This is all propaganda. This time it didn't work. People said, oh my God, what if this happened to me? I don't want the government coming into my house and taking my wife. And because that's what it was all about. But this is all publicity for a relatively small part of the country that the Republicans think they can organize and get to vote for them. All they need is one vote more than the other side. And they will rule as if everybody voted for them.
I have a serious obligation towards each new officer of the Army before he enters into active service. And that obligation is to make clear and definite his responsibility to his government. We are a new nation among the powers of the world. Just 80 years ago, we were fighting desperately for our freedom, and we're still fighting to keep it. We are not yet a wealthy nation, except in spirit. And that unity of spirit is our greatest strength. You men have but one duty, one alone, America.
It has to do with aura. It has to do with an attitude that is projected. And it has to do with I'm part of the culture or I own the culture. And the Republican way of absorbing this question is to assert ownership in all different sorts of ways. And Clinton never did that.
Präsident mit Bodenhaftung? Kleiner Mann? Nein, danke. Warum Journalisten nicht wollen, dass einer mehr wird, der weniger war als sie selbst?
The attitude was very simple. How come this guy's president and I'm not? He's just some jerk from Arkansas. He came from some nowhere family in some nowhere state. And what's he doing as president? You know, he's got more hair than I do. But I'm smarter than he is, and I went to a better school than he did. And, you know, there is that horrible resentment and envy. Whereas with Bush, people say, he was born to be president. You know, he decides to go into politics. He's governor of Texas for 6 years, and then he's president.
Von Abtreibung in den 80ern über Abtreibung heute bis zur Passion Christi.
You know, what's more interesting to me is how who is in the White House affects what people do in culture, what movies are made, what movies people go to see, what records are made, what records become popular, what people are listening to and talking about. Does that change according to the mood of the country or its sense of freedom or lack of freedom? Those are, you know, harder questions to answer. You know, I know how it affects me, but I'm not sure how it affects other people. There's no question that since Bush became president, movies in Hollywood have become generally more conservative. They have, for example, there's a movie made in the early 80s called Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It's a wonderful movie. Jennifer Jason Leigh's one of her first movies, if not her first. And in this movie, a high school girl gets pregnant the first time she has sex, and she gets an abortion. And her brother takes her because she doesn't want to tell her parents. So she goes to the abortion clinic, and she gets an abortion, and then she leaves. That's that. That's all. There's no, nothing is made of it. There's no issue. There's no soul searching. There's no depression afterwards. It's just, I'm 17 years old. I'm pregnant. I don't want to have a baby. I'll get an abortion. Okay, that's a rational thing to do. Today, no Hollywood movie would show anything like that. If there were an abortion scene, the woman in the movie would decide not to have an abortion. And so here is Mel Gibson, and he just made the most successful movie of the last, I don't know, 10 years or something? This enormous success that, you know, it's in Aramaic. I mean, nobody thought anybody would go see this thing. Churches all over the country organized their members to go see the movie. And many people saw it again and again and again. And I think probably it was a very limited part of the country that went to the movie, but all of the people in that part of the country, I don't mean geographically, went. And while Hollywood studios immediately began thinking about opening special Christian divisions of their studios to make their own Christian movies, to pander to what they thought fundamentalist Christians wanted to see, the moral issues appeal only to a certain part of the electorate. It doesn't appeal to most people. Hollywood responds by saying, oh, this is what people want. They don't know what people want. They don't have the slightest idea. And they're stupid, and they're guessing. And they'll jump on anything that looks like a trend. So fear, you know, it's fear of losing money. The fear in Hollywood is the fear that, you know, we won't make as much money as we want to make, and we want to give people what they want.
Erfolgsgarantien ausgeschlossen und ohne Emotionen geht gar nichts.
You know, you have an odd movie like the remake of The Manchurian Candidate, which was very, very explicitly an anti-Bush movie. And it was so transparent that there was no possibility of an actually interesting story or good acting or something that you would emotionally care about emerging from what was, in essence, left-wing propaganda. The only time that movie came to life was at the very beginning when Jeffrey Wright is playing a kind of shell-shocked veteran who's going insane, trying to figure out what happened to him. He's on the screen for about 3 minutes, and that's the time you say, wow, I want to see more of him. You know, this is alive. That's what you want out of art. That's what you want out of culture. You want moments where you say, this is real. This is alive. This is different than anything I've seen before.
1, 2, 3, up. My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
you know, with the Outkast record, Hey Ya, which is really the biggest record in the United States the last 5 or 6 years. What did everybody like about it? They liked the sense of freedom in it, the sense of joy, the sense of, you know, I can do anything, I can say anything, and it feels so great. And yet there's also an undercurrent of sadness, of loss in the song, so that it was much more complex and it affected people in a more complex way than maybe even they realized. That's what happens. And there's no way to predict anything like that, you know? One of the reasons that song was heard with such a sense of pleasure by so many people is that they knew that so many other people were hearing it, and people not like them. In other words, that's one of the great thrills of popular culture, when you get caught up in a shared event and people all over the place who aren't like you, you're sharing something with them that you never thought you had anything in common with them. And you both love this song. And you think, well, that's great. You know, that doesn't mean that we're going to vote the same way or anything like that. But it means there actually is a society here. It's not just, I don't look at you and you don't look at me, and I don't care about people like you and you don't care about people like me. That's the kind of society the Republicans want to create, and they've gone a long way toward it.
Wenn Ronald Reagan der Zeremonienmeister war, ist Wesley Clark ein kultureller Stümper.
I'll give you an example. We're talking about pop culture and politics. Wesley Clark was running for the Democratic nomination for president in 2004, a retired general. And he looked like a great candidate on paper, but he had no idea whatsoever how to be a candidate. He didn't know if he was supposed to say what he really thought or say what he was supposed to say. And people are always telling him, say this, say this, say this. So at one point, he's doing an interview with MTV, and somebody told him that he's supposed to talk about whether or not Outkast is breaking up. So Wesley Clark goes up, you know, goes on TV, and he says, I can tell you, I can promise you, and this is a way of speaking very serious, I can promise you that Outkast is not breaking up. He had no idea who Outkast was, and it was obvious he had no idea. Whereas Bush would have handled that really well. He would have staked his ownership of Outkast. So, well, I might have to talk to those guys. I might have to talk to them about it. Maybe have them at the White House and see if that makes a difference. And that would be convincing. That's really what I think it comes down to. I mean, think of Ronald Reagan when he gave that speech about Bruce Springsteen. And he tried to imply that Bruce Springsteen was endorsing him. And he actually did it really well. He didn't say, Bruce Springsteen endorses me. He's running for re-election in 1984, and he's in New Jersey, and he's giving a speech. And he says, I'd like to pay tribute to one of the great sons of New Jersey. And I'm talking about Bruce Springsteen. You all know who I'm talking about. This is a man, you know, who in his music and in his life stands for all the things that make this country great. People discovering their own dreams, fighting for them, becoming who they want to be. And then he said, helping make those dreams come true is what this job of mine is all about. So he took ownership of Bruce Springsteen. He didn't have to be endorsed by Bruce Springsteen. He said, anything good in this country belongs to me. It's a reflection of me. The country is a mirror. When the country looks in the mirror, it sees me. When I look in the mirror, I see the country.
We may not even live to get our pay, but even if we don't get paid, there ain't no job we trade.
We're hauling freight from state to state along the Santa Fe.
We're hauling freight from state to state along the Santa Fe.
We may not even live to get our pay, but even if we don't get paid, there ain't no job we trade.
We're hauling freight from state to state along the Santa Fe.
We're hauling freight from state to state along the Santa Fe.
Das war eine Gegensprechanlage. Vielen Dank an Grail Marcus für das Gespräch.
Ruby Sirka und Wolfgang Meisinger wünschen einen schönen Abend. Tschüss und
Baba, bis zum nächsten Mal.